So I had a few nice comments from you guys in the quiz. Most of them were regarding the Schmidt decomposition, so I'm going to say a few words about it at the beginning of this lecture. Someone asked a question also about the partial trace and how to take that. So I don't want to go through it now, but if you ask me in the tutorial, I can give you some hints for how to calculate it. But for now, let me just talk about the Schmidt decomposition again. So I told you yesterday that if I have a composite system, A, B, I can always decompose any state in some tensor product basis where one of the elements of the tensor product is the basis for one Hilbert space and the other element is the basis for the other Hilbert space. And they're parametrized, they have these coefficients, A, I, J, where different states will have different coefficients. And I told you that any state written like this can be decomposed in what's known as the Schmidt decomposition, which has the property that all of these states are orthogonal to each other, and all of these states are orthogonal to each other. And the way that it differs from this decomposition is that there's only one index here, so we're summing over one thing. Okay, so one of the questions was, what's the point of the Schmidt decomposition? So one thing that's important about the Schmidt decomposition is that, well, it simplifies a lot of calculations when you have it, because dealing with, you know, this many parameters, well, you're going to have fewer parameters here that parametrize the state than that. But that's not really the most important thing. The most important thing is that this decomposition is unique. And so it uniquely specifies a particular state. And it turns out that a lot of things that we're really interested in, like, for example, the purity or the entropy or other, you know, you can calculate lots of other things, they can all be written in terms of these Schmidt coefficients. So it's just a useful way of parametrizing the state that is unique. And then we can use those parameters to express certain things. And it's also very closely related to how entangled the state is. So the more of these terms that we have in this sum, the more entangled the state is. The other thing is that it's very closely connected to the eigenvalues of the reduced density operators. So if you have this composite pure system, you can calculate the reduced density operators of system A and system B, and you find that both of them, when you write them in the diagonal basis, the bases correspond to the basis of the Schmidt decomposition, and the eigenvalues correspond to these Schmidt values. So that's another important connection there. And so that that brings me to another comment that someone said, that it wasn't obvious why the entropy of system A should be the same as the entropy of system B. Well, the entropy, as you saw, can be written in terms of these Schmidt coefficients, or in terms of the eigenvalues here. And so you see they both have the same eigenvalues, and so they're going to have the same entropy. Even though these basis states are different, the entropy depends only on these eigenvalues. Okay. Right, and then somebody else pointed out that I told you guys a fib yesterday, but okay, sorry.
But that could change if you evolve the state, right?
Well, well, it depends what type of evolution you mean. If you mean unitary evolution on the composite system, then, well, okay.
Then when you split it,
yeah, so if it's an, I'll define a separable or entangling unitary today, but if it's possible that you apply a unitary to this state which increases the amount of entanglement, and so that'll change what these parameters are. But it won't change the fact that when you then go to look at the reduced density operators, they will still have the same ones. So by the same ones, I mean the same to each other. They will, like, all of these guys will be the same. So if these change, for sure these will change, but they'll always be the same to each other. Right. Okay, yeah, and so I wasn't thinking very clearly yesterday when somebody asked, what is the range of this index? So we can actually, we can answer this by looking at the singular value decomposition. So in practice, when you compute the Schmidt decomposition, what you're doing is computing the singular value decomposition for this matrix Aij. And so the way that the decomposition looks is as follows. So if I have this matrix A, which I've schematically drawn like this, and it kind of looks like a vector, but I exaggerated the dimensions of this thing. So we imagine that maybe I runs from 1 to 3 and J runs from 1 to some larger number. And so when if I write this decomposition in matrix form, I will have a small square matrix here corresponding to this smaller index I, a large square matrix here corresponding to the larger index J, and then I will have this rectangular matrix which will be diagonal. So pretty much everything on this side is going to be zeros. And then we will have the diagonal elements of this matrix, which will be these lambda k's. And so the the highest value for this index is going to be equal to the smallest value over which one of these indices runs. While yesterday I said that it's equal to the largest one. Yes?
Are the Aij's the eigenvalues of A, or?
Aij's are the matrix elements.
Okay.
So this will be A11, A12, A21, and so on, yeah. And the same for the other matrices. So, I guess we don't have them written down here. But, this will be like lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, yeah. Yep.
I think the shape of matrix A should be the same with the matrix sigma, right?
Yeah, except turned around. Oh, you think it should be the other way?
Yeah, it should be the same. I mean...
Oh, maybe it's possible. Maybe I've written... Yeah, yeah. So Matt, do you want me to redraw it or is it clear what's going on? Yeah, okay. So maybe I should have drawn it like this. Where the thing is diagonal like that. Is that, yeah. But anyway, it still holds that it cuts it off and the number of elements is going to be the same. Okay, cool. Okay, so what we were talking about last week was the three postulates. So I introduced first the realistic postulate, the ideal postulates. Then I introduced the realistic postulates in terms of statistical mixtures of ideal preparations, transformations, and measurements. And then yesterday we started looking at composite systems. And so what I'm going to do today is use what we learned yesterday about composite systems and entanglement to look at the postulates in a different way. So originally it looked like the ideal postulates were just a special case of the realistic postulates, but now we're going to find that we can derive the realistic postulates from the ideal postulates when we consider a larger dimensional Hilbert space. So we already saw that yesterday when we looked at density matrices. So we saw that if we have a pure state on a larger dimensional Hilbert space, and we look at the reduced density operator for one of the systems, it's going to be a mixed state. So let me just remind you of that here. Okay, so our first motivation for the realistic postulate one, which is that preparations can be described by density operators rho that have a trace one. So the first motivation was probabilistic. So we said, if I have a preparation that corresponds to preparing this pure state psi I with probability pi, then the density operator for that will look like this. But today we will have a second motivation, which is that we look at the reduced state and say the density operator for rho A is equal to tracing out system B of a pure composite system like this. And I'm not consistent with how I label things. Sometimes I put the labels on the bra and the cat, and sometimes I think of this projector as being one object and I put the label there. But they're essentially the same thing. Okay, so, and maybe some terminology. So these are both called mixtures, but we distinguish these types of mixtures with the following language. So the first one is known as a proper mixture. And the second one is known as an improper mixture. I personally would have called them the other way around because I there's something more fundamental and quantum about this for me. But anyway, the language people use is like that. Okay, so let's just look at a very easy example. So if I prepare the pure state zero with probability, half, and the state one with probability a half, then my density operator will be this maximally mixed state. Okay, maybe I will just draw a line here. But what about for the other case? Well, I could prepare a composite system in this maximally entangled state. We know that it's maximally entangled because we can see that it's already conveniently being written in Schmidt decomposed form. So it's already in the Schmidt basis. And so each of the Schmidt coefficients is the same. And yesterday we saw that when the Schmidt coefficients are all equal, that corresponds to maximally entangled. And then we can look at the reduced density operator for that. And so we calculate the partial trace. Let's do it in two steps. So rho AB would be 0, 0. Okay, no, I don't want to do it on the board. Okay, let's just write it down. So rho A, trace out rho B, system B. And we get, again, a maximally mixed state. And so actually that was one of the ways that we defined maximally entangled. We said that if the reduced density operator is maximally mixed, that means that we had a state that was maximally entangled. And so you will look at, you will look at these and see that they are exactly the same density matrices, right? So is there any measurement we could do to distinguish these two preparations? So, I mean, it doesn't look like there's a single shot measurement we could make. Maybe we could go and do quantum state tomography, but if we went and did quantum state tomography, we would find we have exactly the same state. So the statistics for this preparation are going to be completely identical to the statistics for that preparation in, well, in any basis. And so maybe you think it's kind of troubling. For me, it's a little bit troubling that I have these two like completely different preparation procedures that give me exactly the same density matrix. Like, there's no way that you can distinguish between me preparing pure states with probability a half, just randomly and sending them to you, and me consistently preparing this entangled state and just giving you one of those particles. Like, they're indistinguishable. So I think that's kind of interesting and weird and maybe concerning. Okay. Right, so here we talked about density operators as reduced density operators of pure states, but you can actually, at least mathematically, go in the other direction. So given any density operator on some Hilbert space, I can always enlarge the Hilbert space, so introduce some auxiliary system in a way that I can rewrite that state as a pure state on the larger dimensional Hilbert space. So let me write that down. So this is a procedure called purification, and we've heard it alluded to a couple of times in this class. I guess some students have done research using this. Okay, so any density operator rho A can be realized as the reduced, as the reduced state associated with a pure state on an extended Hilbert space. Okay, and that pure state is known as a purification. So if we maybe draw a circuit diagram for that, it means that I can always, if I have some rho, I can always write this as the preparation of some pure state AB, and then I throw away. So usually this is the symbol that people use for throw away. So I get rid of this Hilbert space, I don't have access to it, and then this density operator is going to be the same as that density operator. Okay, so we have these two different ways of preparing density operators. So can we do the same thing with transformations? And it turns out that similar things apply. So the transformations postulate says that any transformation can be written as a CPTP map, so completely positive trace preserving. And we have this Krauss decomposition of the map. So the first motivation we had was probabilistic. We said, well, with probability, well, given some density matrix rho, if I apply the unitary operator ui with probability pi, then that is some non-unitary map on the state. And we can write this in this Krauss decomposed form. We can also do a similar motivation, which is by increasing the Hilbert space and then preparing a unitary operation, unitary transformation on the larger Hilbert space. Okay, so there what I would do is, given some density operator A that I'm interested in, I introduce some ancillary system, let's call it maybe phi. And now I want to evolve the whole thing unitarily. So maybe let's just put some brackets around. And I apply a unitary operator AB. Yep.
That's why the PK there, that's supposed to be gone in the second cell.
Is it supposed to be?
Are we absorbing it, like from your second equality?
No, hang on. What did I do? That's supposed to be like. Oh, okay. Yeah. No, good. Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Okay. So we prepare our system row A that we want to evolve. We introduce some ancillary system. And then we evolve the whole thing unitarily. And now we want to trace out system B. So just to show you diagrammatically what's going on, I have the system row, the state row A, and I introduce some other auxiliary system B. And then I apply a unitary operation to both systems. And then I throw away system B. And so I have some effective description of system A as this density operator. And so I can take this entire thing and call that my map E. And so this thing is equivalent to just taking row A and sending it through this map E and then getting out row A prime. Okay, so how can we see that this actually looks like this Krauss decomposition? Well, to do that, we can explicitly calculate the trace. So let me write the trace as a sum over some basis states for system B I have my UAB. I'm going to do a weird trick where I'm now going to separate, because these things act on different Hilbert spaces, they commute with each other. And so I can just kind of split up this projector and move this ket over to the other side of the row. So I will write that row A like that. And then I can just define this as being my operator AK. And that is the conjugate transpose of that. So I can now say this is.
That is B dagger K. B dagger ABK.
Yeah. Okay, so we have a map written in this Krauss-decomposed form where now AK, rather than being some something proportional to a unitary, it's going to be this strange operator here, which is not necessarily a unitary. It seems a bit weird because sometimes, like often we're used to thinking if we have some operator sandwiched between a bra and a ket, that just gives us a number. But here there's something weird happening that this operator is on Hilbert space A and B, and then we're sandwiching it between bras and kets that act only on Hilbert space, that live in Hilbert space B. And so the thing that we're left with is actually an operator on Hilbert space A. Okay, and so these maps are more general than these maps here. So in the previous days, we've had some discussions about unital versus non-unital maps. So all of the maps that are implemented as probabilistic mixtures of unitaries are necessarily unital maps, so they cannot increase the purity. But these are more general maps, and so it's possible to increase the purity of row A by implementing a map like that. Okay, and I think in the tutorial you guys saw an example of this, the amplitude damping channel, which was the last channel in the last question, was one of these non-unital maps. So that was the one that regardless of what state you put in, it took you to the pure zero state. Oh, and in fact, I'm gonna give you a bit of an example of how this would be done. Okay, so let's look at a physical example. I'm going to prepare an atom, a two-level atom, inside a cavity. So I have some kind of optical cavity that supports, let's just say it supports one mode of the electromagnetic field, and then inside I put a two-level atom. Okay, and the reason we put it inside a cavity is because it makes calculations much easier when we have a single field of the electromagnetic field to play with or to do calculations with. Okay, so let's say I prepare the state let's call this atom and field. So I've prepared the atom in an excited state, and I've prepared the field in the vacuum state, which I'm denoting as a zero, in this case meaning there are zero particles, not the logical zero. And then I can go ahead and do the calculation, which I'm not going to do here, but you could do it. And I get something that looks like this. So here, G is the interaction strength between the atom and the field, and T is the time of interaction. And you can see that for different times, you can have states that are superpositions of the atom being excited and there being no photons in the field, or the atom being in the ground state and there being a single photon in the field. So you could, if you like, think about it as the atom decaying and emitting a photon. Okay, so if we were interested in just the state of the atom, we would want to look at the reduced density operator. And so in the first case, before anything happens, because this is a product state, then the reduced density operator is just going to be a pure state. So we can write it as a projector, or after we evolve it, we can write it as okay, and so now you can see that if we're just considering the two-level atom, then as a function of time, it's going to be oscillating between being in the excited state, then it's going, so it'll be completely pure, then it'll get more and more and more mixed because it'll become a maximally mixed state, and then it can get pure again. So it's going to oscillate between being completely pure and completely mixed. So that's a calculation that we can do, and it's relatively simple because we only have a single mode. But what if we wanted to do a calculation where the atom is interacting with the free electromagnetic field? So you've got all of these different modes. It becomes a huge mess. And maybe we want to find some way of avoiding doing this really complicated calculation. And so in that case, what you can do is have yes?
In the first line, are you just writing down a state? Or I'm not sure what calculation you did to get EA zero to that.
How to get from here to there?
Yeah,
I didn't do the calculation. I just you would have to go through it. So you'd have to write down the Hamiltonian that couples the atom. And so, it's outside of the scope of this course to like go through this whole calculation, but hopefully you can kind of believe it based on physical, based on my physical arguments that you have some sort of coupling strength that couples the atom to the field. And you have a single excitation that can either live inside the atom or as a single particle of light inside the cavity. And it'll just keep oscillating back and forth between the two. Yeah. I mean, if you want, I can add it as a bonus problem to the tutorial where you calculate this, but I removed it for this course because it's kind of outside of the scope of what we were doing. But if you believe that this is how it would evolve in time, then this is how the reduced density operator for the atom would look. Yeah.
Would the sign not be negative from the I?
It's very possible. Yeah. Okay. So what I was saying is that this is a calculation you could do, and I guess even though we didn't do it, hopefully you can see that it shouldn't be too difficult. But if we try and incorporate all of the different modes of the field, you can ask in a second. Let me just like,
it's just that I think the trace needs to be one, otherwise it's probably
Yes.
Whenever you make two mistakes, they cancel out. So what we want to do is find some effective description that lets us avoid doing this incredibly difficult calculation. So the effective description can be done in terms of a set of Krauss operators on just the system of interest. Because to do the full calculation, you would need to consider the entire pure, well, the entire Hilbert space for the atom and all of the modes of the electromagnetic field. And then you would have to evolve this whole thing unitarily. And then afterwards, you would have to trace out the electromagnetic field. But with the Krauss operators, we just have an effective description on the system of interest and all of the physics that's coupling that state of interest to the rest of the world is just going to be captured in these Krauss operators. And the Krauss operators are the ones that you saw in the tutorial yesterday. So imagine for atom coupled to free electromagnetic field can have an effective description. And that'll be in terms of the Krauss operators A0 and A1. Where P goes from 0 to 1, hopefully. Okay, and the physics here is going to be different than the physics of this system, because here what's happening is we have this atom inside a cavity, and the photon that gets emitted, it's going to bounce around and eventually get reabsorbed. So we have this kind of this cyclic thing where the state, the reduced state is going to keep oscillating between being mixed and pure, and it'll just do that indefinitely. While here, because it's a free field and there's no cavity confining it, what you would expect to happen is that if the atom starts in an excited state, it'll eventually just decay to the ground state, and then that's it. The photon floats away, and we just have a ground state. And so that's what you find if you apply this map. If on your Bloch sphere, the zero state corresponds to the ground state, then regardless of where you prepare your state, it's always going to get taken to that pure state, which is the ground state. So hopefully this motivates one reason why you would describe your non-unitary transformations in terms of these maps, because it lets you have a much simpler description of what's happening to your system without having to consider explicitly all of these different interactions with the rest of the world.
And that kind of assuming we already know what the solution is going to be. Like, you can only do it for a system that you already know what the solution would look like.
Yeah, so if you're trying to derive it from first principles, then you could derive it by like knowing what the unitary is on the larger dimensional Hilbert space and like take the partial trace. But another thing you could do is if you just do, rather than doing quantum state tomography, if you do quantum process tomography, then you could have some kind of experiment and you don't know exactly what the physics is behind like how this state is evolving, but you can measure it in many different bases and eventually figure out what the Krauss operators are for that particular system. And then you would have some phenomenological effective description of this transformation that doesn't require you to know all of these different different interactions. So you can kind of you can go from both directions. Okay, and the same as we had with the description of the preparations, we had this notion of purification. So we also have this notion for transformations, and it's in terms of what's known as the Steinspring dilation theorem. Okay, so I don't want to write this whole thing out, but so any CPTP map E on row A can be expressed. So it's implicit that this is on Hilbert space A, can be expressed as the reduced action of a unitary operator UAB acting on the extended Hilbert space HAB. Okay, so in other words, I can always write as follows. Where sigma B is now some ancillary density matrix. And one thing to note is that this representation is not unique. So there are many different unitaries and many different Hilbert spaces that could lead to the same effective description of the evolution on your density operator rho A. One thing to notice, which maybe is just a curiosity, is that in the case of the preparations, we had no way of distinguishing between proper and improper preparations. Any density operator could have been thought of as a statistical mixture of preparations or this reduced action. While here, at least for non-unital maps, you can be sure that it had to be the effective action, but the effective description of unitary operation on large dimensional Hilbert space.
Yep. Is this why, can you explain what reduced action?
Yeah, what I mean by that is that there's unitary evolution on the larger dimensional space,
okay,
and the evolution of the reduced system is the reduced action. It's maybe, well, yeah, what I mean is, apply this on the larger dimensional Hilbert space,
mm-hmm,
and then just look at what happens to the subsystem.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But the point I was just trying to make is that at least in this case, there's a regime where you can distinguish that it's one way of performing this rather than the other. Okay, and finally, let's look at measurements. So our third postulate says that measurements are given by a set of, given by a POVM, which is a set of operators EM that add to the identity, and we have a state, a Born rule in terms of those operators. So again, we had one motivation in terms of probabilistic projective measurements. And then here we have a second motivation which is in terms of projective measurements on larger Hilbert space. Okay, so it's easier to see what I mean by this graphically. So if I imagine that I have some system rho A that I'm interested in applying a POVM to, I would introduce some ancillary system as we did before. I now apply a unitary operation to both of the systems. But now, rather than throwing this away, I'm going to perform a projective measurement just on system B. Or I can think of the combination of this unitary on both systems and projective measurement on B as just being a larger projective measurement on these two systems. And so now I can isolate this entire thing and say this is a POVM. So I can just think of this as applying some POVM to system A. Okay, so let's just convince ourselves that that in fact works. So we can write down the Born rule that corresponds to the probabilities of getting these outcomes M. So let's just go through this step by step. I prepare system A, and then introduce my ancillary system B. And then I apply unitary operation to both of these. Well, yeah. And then I want to perform a projective measurement on just system B. So one way I can do that I've been using P. Okay, so I do nothing on system A, and I apply the projector for system B. And maybe there's a better way of writing this. Let's just write it out like that. And now, according to the Born rule, we then take the trace. So this is going to be the probability of getting outcome M. Okay, so now I'm going to do some similar tricks to what I did before. I can move this guy over to that side. I can use the cyclic property of the trace to split up this projector and move that M to this side. And then I rewrite it as that. And again, we can now identify these things as being these measurement operators that we saw earlier. And then again, using the cyclic property of the trace, I can move this measurement operator over. And we recover the Born rule for postulate 3 for the realistic postulates, where EM equals M dagger M, and okay, so hopefully now you can see that the particular POVM that I want to implement, I can design that how I like, and the way that I design it is by picking a particular input state, a particular entangling unitary, and a particular projective measurement. And if I pick these correctly, I can get an arbitrary POVM. And when you're designing POVMs to do something useful for you, it's pretty much, I mean, it's a creative process trying to think about, first, what's a POVM that can give me some additional power over what I can do with projective measurements? And then given that POVM, how do I decompose it into projective measurements, which are things that I know how to do in the lab? And in fact, I think the last question on your homework is I give you a set of POVMs, and I ask you to come up with a way of implementing those particular POVMs using something like this.
But here your POVM is just one for each the projector is one for each POVM. The EM is equal to M diagram, but in general there can be a sum of M diagram.
Yeah.
How do you implement that?
Then what I would do is similar to that quantum state tomography and subway question that I showed you earlier, where I had a fluctuating basis and then I needed to average over those ones. So I think if you do probabilistic implementations of projectors on here, then you will get that extra sum. You'd need to choose some different bases, as a sample from different bases, which intuitively would make sense, because when we write our... So you're talking about the fact that this can be a sum over I, and then you can have...
So
if you recall the state update rule for that, it was a sum over the density operator sandwiched between these guys. And so that sum is what reduces the purity of the state. If you started with a pure state, then your post-measurement state would be mixed. So intuitively, it makes sense that to get that mixture, I would need to be sampling over some different bases and then mixing it probabilistically. But usually, so that description would be, okay, there are no rules, but usually what I imagine is that description you would use when you're trying to characterize some kind of noise process in your system. But if you're wanting to design some sort of POVM to give you some additional power, you probably wouldn't use that, because that seems to mess things up. You would rather stick to just one term in your decomposition. Okay, and as we saw with the transformations and the preparations, you can also go in the other direction. So there is a theorem called the Neimark's dilation theorem. So let's write it down. I don't actually know. It shows up in different ways. I guess there are different spellings of the same name. But the Neimark dilation theorem. So for any POVM, and any state row A, acting on Hilbert space HA, there exists a projective measurement PM acting on the composite Hilbert space HA and a state phi B acting on Hilbert space HB such that okay, and this, so this is a projective measurement on the composite system, and the projective measurement on the composite system can always be realized as a unitary on the composite system and then a projective measurement on just on one of the systems where this projective measurement acts on Hilbert space B. And this is identity on Hilbert space A. Okay, so what this tells us is that if I invent some POVM that satisfies the properties that a POVM needs to satisfy, then I can always find some way to implement it in the lab just by using, just by introducing a pure state, entangling unitary, and a projective measurement on one of the subsystems. Okay, so what have we seen so far? So we've gone through all of the postulates, and we've seen that all of them can be, all the realistic postulates can be described as the reduced action corresponding to the ideal postulates on a larger dimensional Hilbert space. And we've seen that we can, given some realistic postulate, we can always find some, we can always find some effective description in terms of ideal postulates. And so now that you've seen all of these, what I'd like to do is show you some situations where generalized measurements can actually be more useful than projective measurements. And by generalized measurements, I mean things that are described by POVMs. Yeah.
So in all these cases, we assume that was
served
as a pure state?
Yeah, so, that answers one of the other questions. So B does not need to be a pure state, and I think if we prepare B in a mixed state, then that's another way of getting these subscripts on here and the sum over I. And as I was saying before, if you're trying to come up with something clever, then your best bet is to use a pure state, because then you have the most information and the most control over your system. While if you use a mixed state, then you're necessarily introducing noise into the system. But I think for the trans, I didn't assume that it's a pure state for the Steinspring dilation theorem. But I think in this case, like the, you have the most, I was going to say you have the most control with a pure state, but I don't know if that's actually true. You can do more things with them if you have a mixed state as well. But you can always prepare your mixed state by considering a pure state on a larger dimensional Hilbert space where you introduce like Hilbert space C. So then you can always purify that and extend these things. Okay. So yeah, let's look at some cases where generalized measurements are useful. On yesterday's tutorial, you guys didn't have the question about distinguishability of quantum states, did you? Or closeness of quantum states? That must be on today's tutorial. Okay, yeah, so in the tutorial you'll discuss, you'll see the notion of distance between quantum states and also distinguishability. So, but hopefully it should be kind of intuitive that, okay, let's set this up properly. Okay, so this is kind of a contrived situation, but they do this in quantum information. They always set up particular tasks, and then they ask questions like, what's the best that you can do at this particular task? And usually then you show what's the best that you can do classically, and then you come up with some quantum mechanical way of solving the problem, and often the quantum mechanical way lets you succeed with a higher probability at a particular task. So this is kind of one of those examples. Well, in this case, you don't succeed with a higher probability. You succeed in a different way. But anyway, let's set this up. So consider the following task. You have a friend who prepares one of these two states and sends it to you. And let's assume for the moment that you can only do projective measurements. And your friend asks you to distinguish between these two states. So you want to answer, well, given that they send you that state, you want to tell them, that's the state I got. Given that they send you this state, you want to say, well, that's the state I got. So what's the best that you can do using projective measurements in this case? And you can define best how you like at the moment, for the moment. But maybe one way I would define best would be to say that I get it right with the highest probability. Well, yeah, get it right more often than not. Okay, so if the question was, you know, I send you the state 0 or the state 1, then it's going to be easy. You just make a projective measurement in this case. But here, if you measure in the 0-1 basis, if your friend sent you the state 0, you would always get outcome 0. But if your friend sent you the state plus, then half the time you would get the outcome 0 and half the time you would get outcome 1. So you wouldn't really be able to distinguish this one with certainty. So what's the best that you can do with projective measurements? You have to measure in some basis. So do you have some intuitive notion for what would be the best basis maybe to measure in? You think in this basis?
No, the orthogonal.
The orthogonal along here? That's the basis we want to measure in? Yeah, your intuition is good. That's actually the optimal basis to measure in. And that's what's known as a Hellstrom measurement. So the procedure will be, well, let's measure along this basis. Given outcome corresponding to this state, I will always say, well, I got the outcome plus. Given an outcome corresponding to that state, I say, well, the state you prepared was 0. And there's going to be some overlap, like some situations where you get it wrong, but the situations where you get it wrong is minimized with this choice of axis. Okay, I don't know if I write down the probabilities. Okay, so maybe in this case the probabilities don't matter. The point is that you always have, regardless of what you answer, you always have some chance that you will get it wrong. So you can never say with certainty that it's one or the other. So here we can introduce a set of POVMs that let you say that it's one state or the other state with certainty, but there's a possibility that the measurement just fails and gives you an outcome I don't know.
But like, how do we see that from that example? Like, isn't it pretty clear if it's...
Yeah, so...
So when does the system fail?
Well, it's possible. It's hard to see because on the block sphere, things project in a weird way. So it's let's just call this psi 0. And let's call this psi 1. So you can check, I won't do it because but you can, okay, you can figure out how to write this thing, this state down on the blocks here. Maybe we can even just do it on the spot. What would it be? It'll be some psi 0. It's going to be some state that looks like that, right? And psi 1 is going to be some other state. I don't know. I probably should have written down what they are, but I mean, it's going to be some superposition of these two things. So it means that for each of those measurement outcomes, there's going to be some overlap between, between that state, but also between that state, because that has 0 and 1 components. So you can go through and calculate the 4 probabilities. You can say, what's the probability of getting outcome 0 conditional on preparing the state 0? Probability of getting outcome 1 conditional on 0. You can calculate these 4 possible probabilities, and what you find is that none of them are equal to 0. So it means that given any of these preparations, there's always a non-zero chance that I will get one of these outcomes. So if I get this outcome 1, then I will say it's the state plus, but it's possible that it actually was the state 0. So there's always some
choosing the bigger probability, so
So this is the best that you can do, meaning that you will succeed, like you will be right with the highest probability, but you'll never be certain. So you'll never be in a situation where I say, I know 100%, I'm 100% sure that it was this state. You'll always have some uncertainty because of this overlap between this state and that, between this projector and that projector. But it's true that this is the best choice. If you picked some other axes, then your average probability of success would not be as high. Oh, and I'm assuming that these are prepared with equal probability in this case. But now what I want to do is propose a measurement that will let you say with 100% certainty, with 100% confidence that you know what the right answer is. And that's a POVM. Okay. But there's a trade-off, because sometimes you'll just have to say, I don't know what the answer is. But given that you know what the answer is, you're 100% confident that that's the answer. So for that particular task, consider this POVM. It's going to be a 3-outcome POVM, which will have something that's proportional to the projector onto the 1 state, something that's proportional to the projector onto the minus state, and then we'll have a 3rd POVM, which we call fail, and it's just the identity minus E0 minus E1. So you can check that it's a projective measure, a POVM, because you can add all of these together, and of course you're going to get the identity, because 1 minus E0 minus E1 plus E0 plus E1 equals identity. You can also check that it satisfies the condition that each of these has a positive spectrum. So you can't see it here, but you could go through, from these two you can see that it's true. For this one, you would just calculate the state and calculate this operator and compute the eigenvalues, and you would see that they are positive. But in fact, if these coefficients here were any higher than they are, then it would cause this operator to have negative eigenvalues. So this is pretty much as high as you can get these coefficients without violating the constraint that all of these have to be positive operators. Okay, so let's see how this actually works. So I can draw the projectors corresponding to those POVMs on the block sphere. So the one that corresponds to E1 will be here. The one that corresponds to E2 will be here. And can you guys guess where the third one should be? Maybe using that trick of adding things together? Yeah? Yeah, because we want them to add to the identity. So we want, when you add these three together, you want to get this maximally mixed state. So the third projector will lie here. Well, the projector proportional to that. Okay, and so now we can kind of see why this works, because if I get an outcome corresponding to this and I calculate, given this outcome, what's the probability that this could have been the state? The overlap is zero. So given this outcome, I know for sure it's not that state, so it had to be this state. Given this outcome, there's zero overlap with that state. So given that, I know for sure it's not that state, so it had to be that state. So in both of these two cases, if I get that outcome, I know for sure which state it was. But occasionally, I'm going to get this outcome, which is my fail outcome, and then I will just say, sorry, I don't know, let's choose randomly. Okay, so here is a situation where, depending on how you define success, here is a situation where the POVM can give you more power than just the projective measurements. Okay, so then the second type of generalized measurement that I wanted to talk about is what's known as a weak measurement. So in quantum mechanics, we're mostly used to thinking about projective measurements. And so projective measurements, they give you the most information that you can have about a system. So given an outcome zero, I know for sure that now the state is in the state zero. But they're also the most disruptive, because regardless of what your outcome is, it's going to project the state onto a particular state. So weak measurements, measurements that give you less information about the system, but they also disrupt the system less than a projective measurement. And we'll see tomorrow that there are situations where performing a weak measurement might give you some advantage over performing just a regular strong measurement. So here, let's consider the following entangling unitary. Oh, actually, and this is probably a good place for me to point out what I mean by that. So an entangling unitary is one that cannot be decomposed as just a unitary on one Hilbert space and a unitary on the other Hilbert space. So as you saw in the tutorial yesterday, if you just apply what are called local unitaries, so just unitaries on each subsystem, you cannot change the amount of entanglement. But if you have a unitary that's more general, that cannot be decomposed like this. I can use it to entangle the state or to unentangle the state, and so on. So imagine the following entangling unitary. Okay, so it seems kind of like a mess, but we can kind of work through and see what's going on. So a unitary like that, it's typically what's known as a controlled unitary. So the reason it's called a controlled one is you can see that depending on the state of system A, it will either do something or not to system B. So here, if I prepare the state, if system A is the state 0, I do nothing to system B, while if system A is the state 1, I apply this rotation about the x-axis. So you might recall that this is a rotation about the x-axis by angle chi on 2 on the Bloch sphere. So sometimes in quantum information, the way that they write write controlled unitaries is by having like a little dot on the control system, and then let's see. So if you see something like this, it means that conditional on this state being 1, I'm going to apply this operation to B, but if this state is 0, I'm going to do nothing to B. So that's what's happening here. Okay, I'm kind of worried I won't get to get through all of this. Okay, but now let's imagine a situation where I prepare system A, the one that I'm interested in the state psi, and I prepare this state in the state 0, where psi is going to be a superposition of 0 plus 1. So I can go through and calculate what the effect of this unitary on that state is. And if I go through the calculation, which maybe is one line that I'm going to skip, so let's look at a few limiting cases here. So this is the output state, which is parameterized by this parameter chi, which is this rotation. And so what happens if we get if we set chi to be 0, well, then the output state is going to be alpha 0 plus beta 1. And if chi equals pi on 2, then the output state is alpha 0, 0, plus beta 1, 1. So you can see now what we're trying to do. Okay, and now let's say we're doing a projective measurement on system B. In the 0, 1 basis. So let's look at these two situations. If I measure system, if chi equals 0 and I measure system B in the 0, 1 basis, then it's going to give me no information about system A, because these two things are not entangled at all. So it'll tell me nothing about system A, but it'll also do nothing to system A. It'll just leave system A in this state. If chi equals pi on 2, then measuring in the 0, 1 basis is going to give me maximal information about system A, because the probability of getting outcome 0 here is the same as the probability of getting outcome 0 here. So effectively, measuring this, measuring B in the 0, 1 basis corresponds to having made a projective measurement on A before applying the entangling operation. So in this case, we have no information and no disturbance. In this case, we have maximal information and maximal disturbance. So this is equal to a projective measurement. On system A. So these are kind of the two extreme cases. And then you can, so it's an extreme case between doing nothing and doing a projective measurement. And then you can tune this parameter chi to tune the strength of the measurement. So now there's a whole set of measurements you can do in between where there's going to be a trade-off between the amount of information that you get about the system and the amount of disturbance that you cause to the system. And so what we'll talk about tomorrow is a quantum control scheme where this becomes valuable, because typically when you have some kind of control system, what you're trying to do is to make sure that the state of the system stays, like remains in a particular, well, state that you want it to be. So for example, if you have an oven and it has a particular temperature, you're going to be continuously monitoring that temperature. And if it deviates from what you want, you're going to apply some kind of action on the system to maybe increase the temperature or bring it down. But this becomes a problem in quantum systems, because when you try and get information about the system, you're going to disturb it. And so you want to try and find an optimal measurement that will give you enough information in order to perform your control procedure, but not disturb it to the extent that it'll just completely mess up your control procedure. So that's an example of a weak measurement where we tune this parameter chi, and tomorrow we'll talk about that in more detail. Okay, and maybe just like one final thing that I was going to say. So there's a physicist called John Smolin, and he coined this term going to the church of the larger Hilbert space. And so all of these purifications and dilation theorems and are they both dilation theorems? These are mathematical tricks. So we can, given any realistic operation, we can always think of it as a ideal operation on a larger dimensional Hilbert space. But some physicists kind of give that interpretational significance. So they think, well, maybe the universe is pure, or maybe there's some sort of like meaning behind going behind all these purification things. So I just kind of wanted to put it out there, so maybe you can think about whether you think that there's some more meaning to these purifications rather than just being some neat mathematical trick. Yeah, and it's a matter of debate in the community, like whether you should assign any meaning to that. So there's no answer to that. So with that, I will end, and I will see you at the tutorial this afternoon.